Welcome back. This is part two of our deep dive into low-energy nuclear reactions, the cold fusion saga. In part one, we met the Coulomb barrier, that electrostatic force field keeping nuclei apart, and we heard how Fleischmann and Pons shocked the world in 1989 by claiming they'd broken through it. Today, we're looking at the numbers that define the modern debate, the error bars, the calorimeters, and the hunt for nuclear ash. Because here's the thing, a calorimeter is basically just a device that counts joules going into and out of a box. Simple, right? But an electrolysis cell is a nightmare of a box. It bubbles, it evaporates, it stores chemical energy, and it releases heat where you least expect it.
It's basically a leaking bucket, chemically speaking. Let's start with the scale of the problem. A typical Fleischmann-Pons cell runs on several watts of electrical input power. The excess heat they claim in these papers, it's usually just tens or hundreds of milliwatts. That's 5 to 30% of the input in the strongest datasets, and often under 1%. Let me pause you there. We're talking about a tiny signal riding on a massive background? A couple of milliwatts? Spot on. To figure out if that tiny signal is real, you have to subtract your input power from your output power. But in an open cell, one that vents its gases, the current splits water into deuterium and oxygen, which carry chemical energy out of the system. You only count the cell voltage above what's called the thermoneutral potential as input heat.
Right, and that potential isn't the same for light water and heavy water. It's 1.481 volts for light water, but for heavy water, it's about 1.527 volts.
Yes, a difference of 46 millivolts. If you mess up that calculation and use the light water constant for a heavy water cell running at 1 ampere of current, you have just invented 46 milliwatts of phantom excess heat out of thin air.
Wow. 46 milliwatts of imaginary heat just from using the wrong constant in your spreadsheet. That's easily the size of some of these claimed signals.
It is. Now, to measure the heat coming out, Fleischmann and Pons used what's called an isoperibolic calorimeter. Picture a laboratory thermos, a silver Dewar flask, sitting in a constant temperature water bath. The cell runs hotter than the bath, and you calculate the heat flowing out by multiplying that temperature difference by a calibration constant. Okay, but how do they get that calibration constant? They inject a known power using a small resistive heater inside the cell and watch how the temperature responds. But here's the catch. That calibration constant, which they fit using nonlinear regression, assumes everything stays perfectly stable. But as the cell runs, the liquid level drops, the heat capacity changes because the electrolyte is consumed, and the bubbles change how heat transfers.
So if the calibration constant shifts, even by a tiny bit, your whole calculation goes off the rails. Proponents of this method, like Miles and Fleischmann, claimed error bars as low as plus or minus 0.1 milliwatts. But independent labs, like MIT in their phase two testing, reported error bars of plus or minus 40 milliwatts. That is 400 times larger.
And that's because the proponents were quoting random error, the statistical noise, while the critics were pointing at systematic error, the deep, unmodeled shifts in how the physical cell behaves. If you want to bypass that calibration dispute entirely, you have to build a different kind of machine, like a mass flow calorimeter. Picture a jacket around the cell with water pumped through it at a constant rate. You know the specific heat capacity of water, 4.18 joules per gram per Kelvin, and you measure the temperature rise of the water as it flows past. Practically all the heat ends up in that stream, leaving only a tiny fraction, maybe under 2%, to escape through unmodeled paths.
Oh, so you don't have to fit a massive, complicated equation to a calibration pulse. You just weigh the water coming out and measure its temperature. That's what Michael McCubray's group at SRI International did, right?
It was. Their mass flow calorimeters are the gold standard of the field, though they are slow and sluggish, They average things out over minutes, so they can't see the fast thermal bursts that isoparabolic cells claim to show. And then there's the third type, the Seebeck envelope calorimeter. Seebeck? Like the thermoelectric effect?
Yes, a temperature difference across a junction makes a voltage. In a Seebeck calorimeter, the entire wall of the box is lined with thermocouples, a thermopile. No matter where the heat is released inside the cell, or how the liquid moves, every watt of heat has to cross that wall and produce a voltage. Edmund Storms reported a long-term stability of plus or minus 10 milliwatts under good conditions with this design.
Okay, so we have these three designs, isoparabolic, mass flow, and Seebeck. But the critics still aren't convinced. Let's talk about the failure catalog. How do these experiments make phantom watts? The first big culprit is recombination. In an open cell, if even a fraction of the deuterium and oxygen gases recombine back into heavy water inside the cell instead of venting, that reaction releases massive chemical energy. If you run at 1 ampere of current, complete recombination fakes about 1.5 watts of excess power. That is massive. It dwarfs almost every claimed signal.
That explains the pivot to closed cells then, the ones with catalytic recombiners from around 1992, to force them to recombine on a platinum catalyst inside, so everything is accounted for.
Precisely. That was the community's structural response to the 1989 Caltech critique by Lewis and Miskelly. But then came Kirk Shanahan in 2002 with a much subtler critique, the calibration constant shift, or CCS.
The mechanics of CCS are fascinating. Shanahan argued that no calorimeter is perfectly uniform. The calibration constant you measure with a heater depends on where that heater is. If, during a live run, the heat release zone moves, say, recombination starts happening on the electrode surface instead of the recombiner at the top, the true calibration constant shifts by just 1 or 2%.
And because that 1% error multiplies the entire input power, a 1% shift on a 10-watt cell creates 100 milliwatts of phantom excess. It looks exactly like a real signal, but it's just a systematic drift. Now, the proponents fought back. A 10-author response in 2010 argued that Seebeck calorimeters are position independent, and that CCS doesn't explain why this only happens in heavy water, not light water.
So, with all those traps in mind, which of the heat datasets actually survive this catalog of failures?
The SRI dataset from Macoubre's group is widely considered the strongest. They used closed cells, mass flow calorimetry, and ran hydrogen controls in the same instruments. They reported excess power in deuterium-palladium cells, typically 3 to 10% of the input, and they even wrote down an empirical formula for it.
Let me get this straight. They claimed you need three things to get excess heat. First, a loading ratio of deuterium to palladium, which they called D over PD, above a threshold of about 0.875. Second, a current density of 200 to 250 milliamps per square centimeter. And third, a dynamic deuterium flux. The loading has to be actively changing. It's their formula for their data, not a universal law of nature, but it's the field's most rigorous description. But then there's the Google-funded program published in Nature in 2019.
Right, and Google put serious money into this. First time in decades that well-funded outsiders did state-of-the-art calorimetry on these systems. And their verdict was? A flat zero. No excess heat in 420 tests of nickel hydrogen systems.
But for the palladium systems, their finding was much more interesting. They found that reaching that prerequisite loading ratio of 0.875 is incredibly difficult. They only hit it twice in several dozen attempts. So they concluded that reproducibility fails because the material state itself is extremely hard to access. So it's not necessarily that the researchers were lying, but that they were chasing a material state that is almost impossible to reliably replicate. That is the most generous reading of the null results. But even if we accept the heat is real, calorimetry can never prove a nuclear origin. You need to find the nuclear ash. A fire that leaves no ash is not a fire. Right, and this is where we get to the master move of this entire chapter, commensurability. If you have a nuclear reaction releasing energy, you must produce a specific amount of products for every joule of heat. For helium-4, which is the field's favorite ash, 1 watt of power requires exactly 2.62 times 10 to the 11 helium atoms every single second. Yes, that is the conversion rate from watts to atoms. If you claim a watt of nuclear heat, you must show me 260 billion helium-4 atoms appearing every second. And the most famous attempt to do this was by Melvin Miles at China Lake in 1993.
He sent gas flasks for blind analysis, and he reported helium-4 in the range of 10 to the 11 to 10 to the 12 atoms per second per watt of excess power. That actually brackets the predicted rate.
It does. And later, SRI replicated this with a gas loading setup, showing helium rising above the 5.2 parts per million ambient level of air. But critics immediately pointed out the background problem. Helium is everywhere in the air, at 5.2 parts per million. If a tiny bit of air leaks into your flask or your cell through glass or seals, you get a false positive.
But there's a circular logic to how they handle it, right? Some helium stays trapped inside the palladium cathode, so they have to apply a retention fraction. If they adjust that fraction to make the numbers match the 23.85 MeV-Q value, then the agreement is something they assumed, not something they measured directly.
It is a valid critique, but the even bigger crisis is theoretical. If deuterium-deuterium fusion makes helium-4 in a vacuum, quantum mechanics says it must release a 23.8 MeV gamma ray to conserve momentum, but no gammas are detected. Peter Hagelstein analyzed this in 2010. He calculated that if fast alphas were being born with that energy, they would knock deuterons into secondary fusions and produce neutrons. To match the extremely low neutron limits, the helium must be born with an energy under 20 kiloelectron volts.
20 kiloelectron volts? That's a factor of 1,000 smaller than 24 megaelectron volts. How do you split a single massive nuclear quantum into a billion tiny pieces of heat without releasing any radiation? No accepted mechanism in physics can do that. It is a massive gap between the claimed data and our understanding of nature. And the other proposed ashes don't fare much better. Take tritium.
Right. Fritz Will reported clear tritium generation in closed cells in 1993, well above background, with hydrogen controls showing nothing. But if you run the math on his tritium, it only explains about 1/10 millionth of the claimed heat. That's the scale of the problem. And it gets weirder. The teams at the Bhabha Atomic Research Center in India reported massive tritium, but with a neutron to tritium ratio of 10 to the minus 8. In vacuum, that ratio is close to 1. So they're claiming an 8-order-of-magnitude inversion of normal nuclear branching.
And then there's the contamination shadow. Kevin Wolf at Texas A&M famously retracted his tritium claims after finding his palladium wires were already contaminated with tritium from the manufacturer. It's so easy for trace impurities to ruin the measurement. Contamination is the ghost that haunts every single trace-level nuclear claim. It's the same story with the Mitsubishi transmutation claims. Yasuhiro Iwamura reported cesium-133 turning into praseodymium-141 and strontium-88 turning into molybdenum-96 after deuterium permeated through multi-layered foils.
And Toyota Central R&D did a partial replication, which is impressive. But then the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory tried it. They failed to find any transmutation, but they did find environmental praseodymium contamination in the Mitsubishi lab itself, including on a pair of tweezers.
Yes, and they pointed out that 20 to 200 nanograms of praseodymium can easily be impersonated by molecular ions like cesium oxide or barium hydride in the mass spectrometers. Since praseodymium has only one stable isotope,
you can't use isotope ratios to prove it didn't come from the environment.
Let's look at the CR39 plastic detectors. The SPAWAR group reported etch pits from palladium-deuterium co-deposition, which they interpreted as alpha particles, and even triple tracks from fast neutrons. But other labs showed that the electrolyte itself chemically attacks the plastic, creating identical pits. Shielded chips showed nothing.
And neutrons, which should be the cleanest signature of all, are almost entirely absent. Stephen Jones's original 1989 neutron signal was a picowatt-level effect, and even that was contradicted by Moshe Guy's low background search and Michael Salomon's measurements inside Pons's own lab. The modern Google program found absolutely nothing. So, if we put all of this on a scorecard, what does a believable excess heat measurement actually require? What's the specification for belief? It's a strict list. You need a closed cell to eliminate recombination errors. You need mass flow or Seebeck calorimetry so you aren't relying on one unstable calibration constant. You need blind calibration where the analyst doesn't know which run is live. The signal must be at least 10 times the total systematic error. You need days of integration so chemistry can't explain the energy. You need isotopic controls in the same instrument. And you need independent, hostile replication.
And almost nothing in the literature meets that standard. The SRI data comes closest, but it lacks that final piece, hostile replication. And that brings us back to our two numbers. The Gamow factor says the heat shouldn't be nuclear, and the error bar says much of it might not even be heat. Next time, in part 3, we'll dive into the material science of the palladium-deuterium system to see what happens when you try to force a lattice past its limits. See you then. Welcome back. This is part 2 of our deep dive into low-energy nuclear reactions, or cold fusion. Last time, we looked at the Coulomb barrier, that absolute brick wall of physics, and how in 1989, Fleischmann and Pons claimed they'd beaten it. Today, we're talking about the actual measurements. Because if you say you've made a miniature sun in a test tube, you have to prove it with heat.
Right, and measuring heat sounds like a middle school science project, doesn't it? Just stick a thermometer in a beaker. But picture trying to weigh a hamster while it's jumping around on a scale inside a moving truck. An electrolysis cell is a violent place. It's bubbling, steaming, storing chemical energy, and venting gas. Fleischmann and Pons used what's called an isoparabolic calorimeter, basically a sophisticated thermos sitting in a constant temperature bath.
They're just measuring how much hotter the cell gets than the surrounding bath? That doesn't sound too crazy. But what's the scale here? We're talking about a cell drawing, what, several watts of electrical power?
Spot on. The cell draws, say, 5 to 10 watts, but the anomalous excess heat they claimed to find was only tens or hundreds of milliwatts. It's a tiny signal riding on a massive, noisy background. And in an open cell, where the hydrogen and oxygen gases are allowed to escape, you have to mathematically subtract the chemical energy those gases carry away. That hinges on the thermoneutral potential, which is 1.481 volts for light water, but 1.527 volts for heavy water. If you mix those up while running at 1 ampere, you instantly invent 46 milliwatts of phantom excess heat out of thin air.
46 milliwatts? That's almost the entire size of some of these claimed signals. So a tiny accounting error on paper literally manufactures the cold fusion effect?
It can. That is the error bar half of our story. In an open cell, you're not actually measuring all the energy directly. You're assuming the chemistry behaves perfectly. And as we'll see, those assumptions can fail in very sneaky, very quiet ways.
Welcome back to our series on low-energy nuclear reactions. In part 1, we looked at the massive Coulomb barrier preventing nuclei from fusing, and the 1989 Fleischmann-Pons claim that they did it anyway. Now, in part 2, we are talking about the error bar and how researchers try to measure the supposed heat. If you want to claim fusion, you have to build a better box.
Right,
because an electrochemical cell is one of the least cooperative boxes imaginable. It bubbles, evaporates, and shifts its own liquid level. Traditionally, they used isoparabolic calorimeters, which just infer power from a temperature difference. But to really beat the error bars, you want mass flow, or Seebeck designs. Picture a Seebeck envelope as a box where the entire wall is a thermoelectric sensor, capturing heat leaving in any direction, making it highly position independent.
So it captures everything directly, no matter where the heat moves inside. But what about the phantom watts? If there's no real nuclear reaction, how do these machines show excess heat?
It often comes down to chemistry we didn't budget for. In an open cell, deuterium and oxygen gases escape. If some of them secretly recombine back into heavy water inside the cell, that releases heat. Boom, phantom watts.
That perfectly tees up Kirk Shanahan's calibration constant shift. He pointed out that if the physical location of the heat release inside the cell moves, the effective calibration constant moves with it. Just a tiny 1% shift on a 10-watt cell manufactures 100 milliwatts of phantom excess heat. That is the exact scale of many published claims, meaning systematic error might explain the whole thing.
Precisely. A tiny, unmodeled shift can survive forever, and no amount of averaging will wash away a systematic mistake like that. So if we look at the absolute strongest heat data, we have to talk about SRI International. They used closed cells and mass flow calorimetry, where less than 2% of the heat could escape unmeasured. It's basically a thermal vault. And they found that excess heat only appeared when they crossed a very specific threshold, loading the palladium cathode with deuterium at an atomic ratio of at least 0.875.
0.875? That's almost one deuterium atom for every single palladium atom in the lattice. That is incredibly packed. And if they fell below that number?
Nothing. No excess heat. Below 0.90, the anomaly completely vanishes. But if they pushed past 0.95, McCubbre reported excess heat in every single run. It seemed like a solid recipe, until Google stepped in 2019, with a massive multi-million dollar effort to replicate it.
Okay, but here is where it hits a wall. Google ran hundreds of tests, didn't they? 420 calorimetric tests on nickel hydrogen systems with 50 milliwatt resolution, and they found absolutely zero excess heat. How do proponents explain that massive null?
Well, it turns out Google's null result actually confirmed the materials problem. They found that reaching that magic 0.875 loading ratio is almost impossible. Out of several dozen attempts, they actually hit it only twice. So they didn't necessarily disprove the reaction's operating point. They just showed that the required material state is so rare, almost nobody can reliably build it.
So the defense is basically, our effect is real, you just can't build the stage it performs on. That is a tough sell for mainstream science.
It is. Calorimetry is a highly precise, solved measurement problem, but it's wrapped around a completely unsolved materials reproducibility problem. If you can't reliably get the deuterium into the metal, you can't get the heat. And that's why the debate has dragged on for 35 years.
Which brings us to the crucial pivot. Even if you have the absolute most perfect calorimeter in the world, measuring heat alone can never actually prove a nuclear origin. It just can't. A fire that leaves behind no ash isn't really a fire, right? To prove it's nuclear, you have to hunt down the actual nuclear ash. Right. It's basically like investigating a break-in. If you claim a giant dinosaur ran through your living room, you don't just point to a knocked-over lamp. You need to find actual physical footprints that match the sheer scale of the beast you're claiming was there.
Yes, and in physics, that footprint match is governed by a hard mathematical law called commensurability. Every nuclear reaction releases a very specific, known amount of energy.
So if your excess heat is real, there is a fixed, non-negotiable exchange rate between the watts you measure and the physical products left behind. So let's put that exchange rate to the test. If an experiment claims to produce just one single watt of excess heat, what does the ledger say we should find?
Okay, here's the number. If that 1 watt of power is coming from deuterium fusion producing helium-4, the math demands about 260 billion helium atoms. Not per day, not per hour, but every single second. 260 billion per second for just 1 watt? That is a massive forensic footprint.
Exactly. If you run a cell and find some tritium or helium, but the math says it only explains a millionth of a watt, you haven't actually explained the heat. You just have two different, unrelated anomalies. The ash has to match the fire, point by point, and that is the standard we're holding these next claims to.
If this anomalous heat is truly nuclear, it has to leave behind some kind of ash. The field's strongest card here is helium-4. Back in 1993, Melvin Miles ran a famous blinded study at China Lake and found helium-4 in the effluent gas of active cells at roughly the commensurate rate, about 10 to the 11 atoms per second per watt, which matches the Q value of deuterium fusion.
There's an obvious catch, though. Helium-4 is literally all around us, about 5.2 parts per million in ordinary air. So how do we rule out simple atmospheric inleakage? And doesn't a lot of the helium stay trapped inside the metal cathode? It seems like they have to use a retention fudge factor to make the numbers match.
Right. Critics argue that fitting the retention fraction makes the 24 MeV agreement circular. But even if you accept the helium is real, it triggers a massive theoretical crisis. In vacuum, when two deuterons fuse into helium-4, momentum conservation obligates them to emit a 23.8 MeV gamma ray, but no one is seeing those gammas.
Which is lucky for the grad students, but where does all that energy actually go then?
Theorist Peter Hagelstein analyzed this. To explain why we don't see secondary neutrons from fast alpha particles, any helium born must have an energy under roughly 20 keV. That means that single, massive 24 MeV quantum must somehow be shredded into billions of tiny lattice vibrations, or phonons, without releasing a single gamma. Nothing in accepted physics can do that.
Let's talk about tritium. It's radioactive, easy to spot with a liquid scintillation counter, and some labs did report finding it, like Fritz Will detecting over 200 billion tritium atoms. But here is the catch. When you run the math, that amount of tritium only explains about 2/10 of a microwatt of heat. The experiments are claiming watts. It fails the bookkeeping test by 7 orders of magnitude.
Right, so even if the tritium is real, it doesn't explain the heat. And that's if it is real. Didn't Kevin Wolf at Texas A&M eventually find out his tritium signals were just pre-existing impurities in the palladium?
Yes. Contamination is the specter that haunts this entire chapter. Which brings us to the most extreme claim of all, element transmutation. Yasuhiro Iwamuro's team at Mitsubishi reported that permeating deuterium through layered foils turned cesium into praseodymium. It's a massive jump, adding 4 protons and 4 neutrons at once.
That sounds like alchemy. I know Toyota Central R&D reported a partial replication, but how do we know this isn't another contamination story? We don't. The Naval Research Laboratory tried to replicate it and failed. Instead, they found praseodymium contamination throughout the Mitsubishi lab itself, even on a pair of tweezers. We are talking about nanogram-scale masses here. At those tiny scales, a dirty tool or a molecular mass interference on the spectrometer is easily enough to fake a historic discovery. So once again, when you look closely, the evidence either doesn't match the heat, or it melts away under a clean set of tweezers. A tough sell for the nuclear hypothesis.
Welcome to the second half of our story. In our last episode, we broke down the Coulomb barrier, that massive electrical barrier, and how Fleischmann and Pons claimed to beat those impossible odds back in 1989. To understand if they actually bypassed it, we have to look at the yardstick we use to measure success. That means looking at two numbers, the heat we measure and the physical ash left behind. If we are genuinely talking about nuclear reactions, shouldn't there be a massive spray of neutrons? Like the kind of radiation that's impossible to miss?
Instead of a roar of radiation, we find absolute silence. If this were standard deuterium fusion, 1 watt of power would demand trillions of neutrons per second. But when physicists like Moshe Guy and Michael Salomon tested operating cells, the neutron rates were up to 12 orders of magnitude below what the heat required. The forensics are unambiguous. It's not standard fusion. 12 orders of magnitude isn't just a minor discrepancy. It's a canyon. So what does the final scorecard actually look like for these claims? Picture a trial where the physical evidence keeps evaporating. On one hand, the calorimetry remains highly contested. Opponents like Shanahan show how a 1% shift in calibration can manufacture phantom watts. On the other hand, the nuclear ash, like helium-4 or tritium, is entirely unproven, continually dogged by trace contamination. We're left with a solved measurement problem wrapped inside an unsolved reproducibility problem.
So the physics says it shouldn't happen. The error bars say the heat is highly questionable, and the nuclear ash is missing. But we aren't done. In part 3, we'll dive into the materials. What actually happens when you try to force deuterium into palladium? So we're left with this persistent, maddening gap. On one side, incredibly precise claims of heat and nuclear ash. On the other, a stubborn trail of contamination doubts and calibration arguments that just won't go away. It really is a tug of war, where neither side can quite drag the other across the line. But next week, in part 3, we are moving past the calculators and detectors to look at the heart of the actual recipe. How experimenters squeeze massive amounts of deuterium into a metal lattice, and what happens to the chemistry when it is packed to the absolute limit. It is where the material science gets incredibly weird. We will see you then.